You're listening to Femme Innovation, hosted by Bethany Corbin. Bethany is a trailblazing leader and top voice in women's health technology and femtech. She inspires entrepreneurs to transform society's perception of women's health by disrupting and enhancing standard models of healthcare delivery. In this podcast, Bethany connects with the industry's most powerful and innovative voices to facilitate hard conversations about the status of women's health and break down barriers and taboos that restrict access to necessary healthcare services. This podcast is not intended as legal advice and is not an endorsement for any product or company. Now, here's your host, Bethany Corbin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of Femme Innovation. I'm really excited to tackle a topic today that a lot of femtech founders struggle with, which is product launch and commercialization. And joining me today are two incredible experts in this space, Daniela Kapurl and Swathi Rangan, both of whom are from Hirschbiegel. If you're not familiar with Hirschbiegel, Hirschbiegel was founded with a mission to pioneer a model for successful pharmaceutical product launches that would produce consistent, predictable success. And after successfully launching over 125 pharmaceutical products, Hirschbiegel has now expanded its services and is really working to encompass a variety of other industries, including health technology and femtech. And Daniela and Swathi are two incredible experts at product development, product launch, and product commercialization. And they're going to talk to us about what all those terms mean, what you need to be thinking about as you gear up for product launch, why it's important to test your product market fit before you launch, and everything in between. So very excited for this conversation. Swathi, Daniela, welcome to the show. I think this is going to be a fantastic discussion, and I can't wait to get started.
Perfect. We are very excited as well.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you both so much for being here. So you both currently work at Hirschbiegel, which is a leading provider of commercialization services to pharmaceutical and biotech companies. And I was just wondering, can you walk us through your career journeys and how you actually got into the product development and commercialization space?
Sure, happy to. It's a bit of a long journey, but not an uncommon one in this industry. I actually have degrees in both biology and chemistry. And I initially started as a bench scientist 15 years ago and found that while I loved the problem solving and interacting with individuals and the business aspect of my job, you know, I think at least for me, that was much more rewarding and fun than the research aspect. And so as a bit of a science nerd, I kind of wanted to stay within the industry, but hone in on what we like to call transferable skills. So I actually opted to get my MBA and a master's in pharmacology. And so on the bench science side, if you go back to, you know, my prior roles, you're often so far removed from the actual value. And I wanted to be closer to seeing how I actually impacted the consumer, how I actually impacted the patient. So I spent a little bit of time in a marketing role within a diagnostics firm before I actually made the transition into consulting. And at least for me, I found that I enjoyed being on that continual learning path and learning trajectory, which often comes with consulting roles. And so now I've been here for, I think a little upwards of 8 years, and I've really enjoyed helping others solve for key commercial issues.
So yeah, my background is in business. I actually started off with an internship in corporate finance, where I quickly realized that that space was not for me. I was very lucky to have a mentor in college who worked in pharma for over 25 years and was able to steer me in the direction of, you know, help combining healthcare and business. And that's how I ended up at Hirschbiegel, and I've really enjoyed kind of blending healthcare, business, strategy, and working with clients to really shape their products and help them succeed.
That's incredible. And I know both of you, you know, both of your journeys took you to Hirschbiegel. So tell us more about Hirschbiegel and the work that you actually do with founders. And then separately, also talk to us about why you're interested in femtech and women's health companies in particular.
So we work with a lot of different types of companies. We work with pharma, biotech, digital health, and startup companies, small, medium, and large. But when it comes to specifically working with startup founders, the majority of our work we do is particularly in commercial assessments. So helping our clients optimize their approach relative to their product and goals. So that can include anything from strategic planning, market research, financial assessments, and helping identify, you know, their ideal business model and tactical plan that, you know, makes the most sense for the solution that they're trying to bring to market. And when it comes to femtech and women's health in particular, you know, this is an area that at least I'm really passionate about. I know so many of my colleagues are as well. And I've dedicated a lot of time into this space. And I think that, you know, working in a space that has for so long been so underrepresented and underinvested in is so important. And femtech has really been that emerging catalyst to push the needle forward within women's health, to increase innovation and investment in the sector. Anything we can do to be a part of that space and bring more awareness to women's healthcare, I think is really important, you know, for paving the way for accessibility, affordability. It's a really exciting space for us to be working in.
For me, it provides an avenue to work on something that has like a direct impact. So women also present with such unique challenges to common illnesses as well, ones that haven't been historically studied. And, you know, this is roughly half of the entire population. Also, not to mention helping shape an industry impacted by like economic, social, and cultural factors is also extremely rewarding.
I agree completely. And as you both mentioned, right, this is an area where we can have a tangible impact on the outcomes for more than half of the population. So I love that we've all got a similar passion for driving innovation in this field. And it's interesting too, right, because we come at it from such different angles. You know, I come at it from the legal perspective and you all come at it from the product commercialization perspective. I'm so curious because a product is definitely not something I am super familiar with. So what does product commercialization actually mean and what does it entail?
It is definitely a bit of a catch-all phrase, and I feel as though everyone has a little bit of a spin and a different response to this. At least for me and to Hirschbiegel, commercialization encompasses the life cycle of how to successfully build, launch, and scale a product in market to essentially maximize its potential. This traditionally contains several different functions interworking to achieve that across this journey. So it's everything from clinical or regulatory, marketing, manufacturing, distribution and access, and much more recently and relevant in the space is really tech and data and how you integrate all of that across the functions.
Fascinating. I wish I knew more about that and how that actually works. So I'm very glad that there are companies like yours that thrive in this space. And I know product commercialization is a huge factor for femtech companies when they're trying to get their products to market. If you are a femtech founder, right, you're developing a product, one of your primary goals is to actually get to market as quickly as possible to launch your product. So a couple of related questions here. Just when should femtech founders actually start thinking about product commercialization? And what are some of those aspects of product commercialization they need to think about at that stage?
Sure. So there's a couple of different things. I think, first of all, when you're thinking about product commercialization, right, I think there is no time too soon to start really thinking about how you want to bring your product to market. So I would say my very consulting-esque response is as soon as possible. You always want to be thinking about the value of your product, what it can bring, what it can solve for, and how you plan on actually bringing that and scaling that within the marketplace. That said, there's a few elements that you need to essentially have in place before you fully flesh out and build out your product. One, I would say, is defining your product. What is the actual concept and what is the unmet need that your product is solving for in the marketplace? How will it work? What is the value you bring? And you really need to clearly sort of flesh out this concept. The second piece is actually understanding the market. I think oftentimes we work with a lot of companies who might shortchange or maybe not really take the time and energy to fully assess and validate that this is a true unmet need and that there is a true market and target consumer for this product. So you really need to understand who is your key consumer and how will this add value relative to other solutions that are in the marketplace. And that's done through market research. The third piece is really, I would say, identifying your overall strategy and your goals. What are your key milestones that you want to hit? When do you want to launch? What does a successful launch look like to you? And being very clear about defining these, because that will often help you identify what your investment strategy might need to be relative to ensuring that you have the financial capital to actually realize success within your product in the marketplace. So I would say, ensuring that you have very clear goals and a clear idea of those milestones that you want to hit is also going to be really important before you even fully flesh out and develop your product.
That's so interesting. And something I think that a lot of founders need guidance on, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think that's something that naturally comes to them, right? Or things that they're necessarily thinking through whenever they're trying to get that product to market. And so kind of, you know, kind of given that framework and, you know, the number of companies that you work with across the healthcare space, are there common mistakes that you see digital health founders or femtech founders in particular making when they are developing this commercialization strategy?
I would say that there's probably three most common mistakes that we see across the board. I would say number one is a clear understanding of your customer market. So I think it's really important for founders to understand how their end users are going to interact with their product every step of development. So, you know, without validating your assumptions with your customer base through every phase, you're going to run into some disorganization. You're going to lead into, you know, potentially some loss of time and money, which we definitely want to avoid. So we really want to make sure that our clients, you know, do their research and make sure they quantify and qualify, you know, all of those kind of insights for their investors before they move forward. The second most common mistake we see would be a lack of scalability. We often have to remind founders that, you know, you can't launch with everything as soon as you go to launch. You have to build your business model to be flexible so that it can grow with you, right, as your customer base and revenue grows. So throwing, you know, all your resources into having this fully developed product with all the bells and whistles at launch isn't necessarily going to, you know, make you the most successful organization long term. And it might even cause some financial problems and some disorganization as well. The third most common mistake, I would say, would be a lack of planning around willingness to pay and reimbursement channels for your customers. So really thinking about who is your end customer going to be, whether that's a patient or an HCP, a healthcare provider. You know, you have to scenario plan around your product and what kind of payment model fits best for your goal and consumer. So, you know, the best example right now in trends for digital health is this pivot from prescription digital therapeutics to a more over-the-counter approach. So we know that, you know, more recently payers are really struggling to see the value in prescription digital therapeutics, and therefore they're less than excited to reimburse for those types of products. So we see companies, you know, such as, let's take Akili, for example. They have a mental health product for ADHD. They've recently applied for over-the-counter designation from the FDA, and they were previously a prescription digital therapeutic company only. So really like following those trends and making sure that whatever, you know, distribution channel or payment model you choose matches who you're trying to target. I would say those are the three most common.
I would just add to that, I think the most important aspect is validating that upfront too. I think the biggest mistake that individuals can make is launching a product. For example, maybe it's an app, and then expecting that to generate a solid amount of revenue, either through subscription models or I would say like another avenue, but really not hitting their goals because they're finding that it doesn't have as much uptake within the marketplace as they had expected. So ensuring that you're very clear about that value and understanding your target consumer and understanding their willingness to pay as well relative to that, I think is really imperative prior to launch. And then as you launch as well, and when you're in that post-launch product lifecycle phase, it's continuing to build on that, to evolve your product, to scale your product, and ensuring that whatever price point that you're setting it at is matching what the marketplace expects and is willing to pay.
That's amazing advice. I truly think, you know, what you just said there, Swathi, about making sure that you're setting a price point that your consumers are going to be willing to pay is essential. Because I know in femtech in particular, there's a lot of products being offered direct to consumer because of the, you know, the exact issue that Daniela was mentioning with respect to payers, right? Not necessarily being willing to reimburse, especially for these newer, you know, apps and wearables and things like that. And so I would imagine it's, you know, difficult and takes a lot of research to try to find that price point or, you know, what's similar out there on the market that consumers would be willing to pay. So I think those are incredible points.
Exactly. I tend to find that, at least with the work that we've done, that when it comes to willingness to pay and when it comes to this marketplace as well, it's very different between one end user to the next, depending upon that reimbursement channel also. So if you potentially have, you know, a payer willing to cover some of it or an employer willing to cover some of it, right, that payment scale drastically differs for that consumer as opposed to something that might have been direct to consumer in the first place. So definitely understanding your business model and how you plan on launching and what might look like the optimal approach is going to be really imperative.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And as you mentioned, right, business model is key, and as is flexibility. As femtech products are coming onto the market, right, and they're being commercialized, they do have to select a primary business model. But personally, I have seen a lot of founders struggle with this. And, you know, I've seen a lot that, you know, evolve over time, right? They might start direct to consumer, and then they might try and get payers to adopt or go, you know, B2B or, you know, evolve, as Daniela mentioned, and having flexibility. But how does a femtech company or a healthcare company find the right business model? And are there some common business models that you see in the digital health field?
That is an excellent question. And I think it depends. It depends on what your product is, right? So when you think about digital health, femtech, that kind of encompasses a multitude of things in women's health overall, right? It can be everything from like the pharma, the drug, the product itself, to a health wellness app. It can be a wearable, it can be a diagnostic, it can be a med device. So there's multiple, and you know, I think there's a few others that I could definitely reference, but there's two different types that kind of encompass women's health and femtech overall. And I think depending on your product, you'll ideally have an idea of who your end consumer and customer might be. If it is health and wellness app, for example, depending on the value it brings and who you're actually expecting to find the most amount of value relative to your solution, that kind of helps you target and identify what your primary model at least needs to be. So if it's an app, a lot of times it is going to be direct to consumer. And as Daniela even mentioned, we are seeing this trend and we are seeing this, I would say it's a little bit of a hesitancy almost, right, for payers to appropriately cover, you know, digital health overall in this space. So you are finding that there's more direct to consumer and a shift there. But that said, and Bethany, I think you even said this really well, while that might be your primary business model, that in no way, shape, or form is your secondary or tertiary. And oftentimes, your actual optimal business model winds up being a permutation and a combination of multiple of these. So you might start launching direct to consumer to ensure that you're gathering the appropriate amount of data. You can have real world evidence. You can have retroactive studies to actually have proof of concept and clinical validation. And then take that and find value with payers, find value with employers, find value with other stakeholders to then ensure that you're generating revenue in an additional manner, but then also scaling appropriately to reach the ideal consumer and customer.
That's brilliant. And I fully agree with everything that you've said. I think it's so important that you identify the appropriate business models out there for the product that you're building while keeping an eye towards the future and knowing that those business models are likely going to change as your product evolves and adapts as well. So
completely agree. I think one thing to always consider as well is this is going to adapt and change as the market continues to evolve. Digital health has obviously been the hot topic for a little bit and will continue to be. And as we've seen, you know, technology and data just tends to become, you know, more complex and more exciting, but that also means there's more regulations, more concerns. So as all of this shifts and as we're able to gather data and connect it in different manners and mechanisms, that also might shift in the future in terms of who you might be willing to partner and scale with and work with relative to your business model as well. So I think there's an aspect of planning and ensuring that you have a few different scenarios in mind of how you want to scale and what your primary model should be, but also how you want to shift that in the future. But then you also need the ability to adapt as the market evolves.
Oh, absolutely. And Swathi, you know, something that you said there, you know, about scaling, you know, it's almost as if you need to have a plan for scaling at the time that you're developing your initial product that's ready for launch so that you can know how you might have to adapt or change or, you know, change your business model in the future as well. So I think that's also an important point to highlight is the necessity of thinking about scaling at the early stages, because I think so many founders wait until they've launched, right, or they're ready to scale or evolve to even start that thinking process.
Yeah. And I would say this, I think that it's fine to do that, but then that just means there's going to be a greater amount of delay before you can appropriately scale and reach that volume and see that ROI or see that financial and, you know, product uptake that you're really expecting. You know, often we have seen some companies take, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, six. I think one we've worked with even took upwards of like 8 to 10 years, which to me gets into the pharma space, but of really like developing, refining, ensuring that they were gathering all of the clinical evidence necessary before even fully launching and scaling their product. So I think that's where it also goes back to defining your key milestones and making sure you have a clear predictor and understanding of what success looks like and ensuring that like year by year, you're setting those clear goals.
Oh, I love it. I think that's incredible advice for the founders listening out there. And I want to go back to another item that you had mentioned when we were talking earlier, which is differentiation. So differentiation is one of those key terms that I have continually heard from investors who are looking to fund femtech products. They want to know how that product is going to be different than what's on the market and what that value add is, Daniela and Swathi, that you were talking about earlier. So how can a femtech company actually determine their differentiators? And I know this is something that you help them with as well. So how do you help them along this process?
Yeah, I think when it comes to differentiation, you have to have a lot of faith in the founders. You know, they've already done the heavy lifting. They've identified a problem that needs to be addressed and they have an idea about how they want to fix it, right? So what we usually do with our clients is we contextualize their product within the competitive landscape. So we help them determine, you know, what is their point of differentiation relative to the existing market? So whether that's convenience, accessibility, cost effectiveness, safety, efficacy, whatever it may be, it's really important that we help our clients define their differentiators by comparing, you know, to the rest of the market, like I mentioned, but then taking that a step further and then verifying that with market research. So like I mentioned, I think in the beginning, you know, verifying every step of the development process is critical for making sure, you know, that your customer base that you're targeting is reacting positively to what you're developing. So you're not wasting time and money in the future, you know, looking back like, oh, what have we created now? It's really important every step of the way to pressure test those ideas and your assumptions. So I think that that really helps define and clarify what those points of differentiation can be in the future and lead to a more successful launch.
Oh, that's fantastic. And truly, I think that's right. And what you said too about pressure testing along the way, one of the things that I have seen in terms of, you know, mistakes that founders make sometimes is they don't necessarily do a soft launch, right? Or test their products with a particular group of individuals before they launch on the market. Is that something that you've seen? How do you all feel towards, you know, soft launches, that type of thing?
Yeah, so we've actually seen this quite a few times, and I think it's a really great idea. You know, I've seen a client in the past do a sort of mini launch to start with a really targeted, specific approach, you know, with specific physicians that they wanted to target. And then they waited 6 months, collected as much data as they could, and then went for a full-scale launch approach after that. I think it was really beneficial because they could tweak all of those things that maybe didn't go as well within that initial targeted launch. So whether that's, you know, the user experience or maybe some issues with distribution, they're able to tweak those things and they're able to also collect other information, whether it's like patient satisfaction or, you know, understanding what the benefits and withdrawals were. So I think it's something that's becoming a lot more commonplace. And I think it's actually, it's a really good best practice to have.
Just to add a little bit onto that too, the benefit of a targeted launch, and when we say targeted, there's multiple ways to do it, right? It can be a very small population. It can be targeted in certain geographical areas. It can be, I would say, in a certain segment or like type of end user that you want as well. The other benefit of doing that as well is cost, financing. If you think about marketing costs for a large scale volume of consumers, that drives your cost up very, very quickly. If you think about like DTC costs and ad search, all of your, I would say like online costs as well and media costs that are attached to that, that will escalate into the millions very quickly and scale beyond. So to help sort of combat that up front, and also to Danielle's point, ensure that you can actually validate your solution before you're spending all of this money into your marketing efforts, which tends to be the most expensive, you want to take that time to sort of have like that proof of concept and proof of product as well. And the other component, if you're doing your targeting correctly, is you can actually generate stakeholders who will advocate for your product and who will champion your product for you. So it's that grassroots marketing efforts that you can kind of cultivate in that upfront timeframe as well. So there's a lot of benefits to sort of approaching launch with that scaling mindset that are not just from like the clinical evidence generation standpoint, but also can be just a better way to sort of scale out and phase out your costs as well with a little bit more certainty.
Oh, I like that. I think that's something a lot of founders are worried about too, is cost, right? How much they have to spend up front. And, you know, and I think the old saying of, you know, don't let perfection get in the way of progress is absolutely applicable to startups that want to kind of, you know, full launch with all the bells and whistles for their products. That's actually one of the concerns I've heard about doing kind of soft launches, is they say, well, you know, my product's not ready, right? What if consumers don't like it because it doesn't have all the bells and whistles? But I think for the exact reasons that you've mentioned, there's so many benefits that outweigh having the perfect product ready to launch and go to market. And I think the cost spreading that you mentioned, Swathi, is a huge benefit as well. So I really appreciate you bringing that up. And, you know, as we're talking about growing and scaling, a lot of femtech companies are interested in entering into partnerships with other healthcare organizations or tech companies. And I'm curious, how can partnerships really help to support commercialization? And are there any key considerations that founders might want to think about as they evaluate partnership opportunities as a way to grow and scale?
Yeah, I think partnerships can be extremely helpful when it comes to the commercialization process. So whether it's, you know, wanting to scale across, you know, specific channels, increasing your breadth and your depth, or, you know, growing your capabilities and your service offerings, or enhancing the patient experience, partners are a great way to help support your business growth. We've definitely seen this in the past. I'll just give an example. One specific client partnered with another digital health company because they were already integrated within the specific healthcare provider specialty that they were looking to target. So that was sort of a match made in heaven and was really beneficial to their business growth. But there are definitely a lot of considerations that you want to keep in mind when approaching a potential partnership. I think it has to be done in a really meaningful way. You want to make sure that you are definitely in a partnership and, you know, making sure there's a difference between what it means to have a partner and a vendor, making sure that you and your partner are strategically aligned across the board, making sure that, you know, as the market evolves, as Swathi mentioned before, you know, digital health is ever evolving, ever changing. You need to make sure that your partner is able to keep up, like that relationship is able to keep up with that, those changes. And then, you know, making sure that you understand the full commercialization process as partners, you know, from beginning to end. And then also making sure that you understand your degree of control within the partnership versus, you know, you versus the partner, making sure that, you know, throughout development that there is identified lines of sort of demarcation in terms of what you are responsible for and what your partner is responsible for. That way there's no confusion or disorganization in the future.
Yeah, I think Daniela mentioned one interesting point that I just want to elaborate on. I think the aspect of a partnership versus a vendor, and this is one where we've seen oftentimes go a little bit off the rails relative to when we're entering and working with some of our clients. But it's really important to ensure that you and your identified partner both find strategic value in your partnership. And it's not just monetary, unless that is your end goal. So ensuring that you both have a stake in the game and you both have alignment across your overall commercialization and launch strategy relative to what your partnership is attempting to define. Another component and benefit of a partnership, I think, is cost, right? I think a lot of times you may not have the capability or the manpower to really fully scale a product and fully scale a launch. So having that partner and having their legs to help accomplish and do that can be really beneficial and very meaningful if done correctly.
I think you're 100% right, Swathi. And Daniela and Swathi, I loved that you both said that there's a distinction between a partner and a vendor, because I think sometimes those lines get blurred as founders are thinking about how they want to grow and scale. And vendors can definitely help get you there, but those partnerships are going to have the mutually beneficial relationships that drive the end goals for both organizations very strategically. And so I think that's absolutely something to think about whether, you know, a partner is a true partner or whether they're a vendor. So I love that you mentioned that.
Completely agree.
I want to switch gears just for, you know, kind of the last little portion of our podcast and talk about risk. So identifying risk early for startup companies is crucial, but I've found that founders actually differ on their degrees of risk aversion. And I know that your company really helps startups with early risk assessments. So can you just tell us, you know, why risk assessments are important to founders and how founders should look at risk?
Sure. So I think when people think of risk, the first thing they think about is, oh, dollars. I need to ensure that I'm not wasting dollars, or I'm creating something that has value. I'm going to create something that I can scale and launch and get to that positive ROI as fast as possible. But I think there's a lot of elements of a risk assessment that need to be considered when you're actually building the overall trajectory for a product launch. I think one, as I've mentioned, is obviously let's ensure that we are scaling this product appropriately relative to what you're developing. Let's ensure that it's creating and meeting an unmet need. Let's ensure that there is a market for it. Let's ensure that we're creating like some type of forecast modeling that has different models so we can figure out what the optimal like business approach and commercialization approach is. Let's ensure that we understand how long it might take to break even so you understand the risk that you're taking. Let's ensure that we understand how competitors are doing relative to what you're trying to solve for, and if now or even in the future, what your competition is going to look like so we can frame that in as part of your overall trajectory. The second piece is part of the risk assessment as well, and you need to start to incorporate, especially when we're thinking about digital health and femtech, is really the element of data security and data integrity and compliance and, you know, patient secure information, PHI. All of these elements are drastically evolving in terms of what we're actually able to collect relative to the technology now, and that will only continue to evolve in the future, especially as we think about AI and some of these other advances that are becoming a little bit more, I would say, permeated within the industry, and healthcare is starting to utilize them more frequently as well. So ensuring that you have data security and ensuring that you're considering risk to, you know, your end consumer and your patient, and incorporating this as part of your product development, incorporating this as part of your resourcing and staffing, and ensuring that you're accounting for that element of risk as well relative to what product you might be, you know, creating, building, and scaling is also going to be really imperative. So there's like a multitude of aspects that you really need to consider as part of, you know, your initial early risk assessment to ensure that A, your product is going to be successful, but then B, you're also protecting yourself as a company, but also you're protecting your end user and consumer as part of it.
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting, right? Because I look at it from the legal perspective. And so oftentimes founders are, you know, I see them thinking about legal risk whenever they're thinking about risk assessment. And it's so interesting, right? Because they tend to have almost a laissez-faire approach to saying, well, I'm a startup, right? What are the odds that this is a real risk?
Right now. Exactly. When I'm larger, I'll figure it out.
Exactly. I hear that so often. And it's interesting because I've actually had to modify how I talk to startups about risk so that it's not, okay, you know, here's a legal risk, right? But here's more the risk to your reputation or your ability to grow or launch in the future. And I find that resonates more than something as, you know, like legal risk, right? Or just the monetary risk.
Oh, yes. I will tell you, with like certain founders and individuals, you will immediately see like the difference in just like understanding what we're speaking to when we're like, it's a compliance issue versus, hey, if we're thinking about the future and these are the data points that you need, how are you going to safely collect them now to be able to have proof of concept later and not run into these hiccups? Because that is going to impact your forecast and your growth potential.
Yes. Yes. Oh, it's interesting to see that you have to kind of tailor the conversation mm-hmm. similarly. I wasn't sure if it was just me, so.
Oh, no. So, always have to speak to your audience, understand what resonates, and reframe in that capacity.
Well, Swathi, Daniela, this has been such an incredible conversation. I have learned so much myself about product commercialization and development. I want to be a fly on the wall for all of these conversations that you're having with clients, because I think the value that you're bringing is so immense. And so thank you so much for the work that you're doing in the women's health and femtech space, along with the broader healthcare and pharmaceutical spaces as well. For our audience members who are interested in getting in touch with you or learning more about, you know, Hirsch Spiegel's offerings and how they can partner with you, where can they find you?
Sure. You can find me on LinkedIn very easily. And I believe Daniela as well can also go to our website to learn more and get a sense for the type of commercialization work that we've actually done. We have several case studies. We have examples and I would say more details around our capabilities and how we're able to help. But please feel free to reach out. We are more than happy to provide any type of support and also just have, you know, conversations and grow our own network. And Bethany, I just want to take the time to thank you as well. This has been fantastic. And we've really appreciated being able to share some of our insights that we've gleaned over the years. It's been very wonderful speaking with you today.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you both so much. To our listeners out there, I will be sure to include Daniela and Swathi's information in our show notes. And thank you so much for listening. If you are at all interested in learning more about commercialization or product launch strategies and scaling strategies, please don't hesitate to reach out to Swathi and Daniela. They are incredible resources as you're looking to grow and scale. So thank you all so much for listening. And we hope to see you back here next time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Femme Innovation with Bethany Corbin. To connect with Bethany, follow Femme Tech Lawyer on Twitter and Instagram, visit her website at femminnovation.com, and connect with her on LinkedIn. If you found value in this show, we'd really appreciate a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. That helps others find the show. Thanks again for tuning in to this episode of Femme Innovation with Bethany Corbin. We hope you'll join us again next time.